Hello and welcome to the winter season of Beyond the Screenplay. I'm Michael Tucker and I'm joined today by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So, with this season, as we are leading up to the Academy Awards, we're going to be exploring the question, what makes a film Oscar-worthy? We're going to be discussing some brand new films that are nominated for Best Picture and other things, as well as some classics from the Academy Awards of the past. And I wanted to start the season by thanking all of you patrons out there who make the show possible. And when we say that, we mean that. We're certainly not doing this podcast because we're trying to get rich. We love just dissecting movies and interacting with you guys on Patreon and Discord. We all have very busy, full lives. And so anything that helps make this podcast self-sustaining and possible is deeply appreciated. And I also want to remind everyone that we tried to create a lot of value for our patrons on Patreon, which is why this season patrons are going to get 3 Patreon exclusive episodes. So these are full episodes. Chinatown, which we released last week as a sort of soft launch to our winter season. A conversation about acting and Fargo. So those are 3 Patreon exclusives. And of course, when you sign up on Patreon, you're also getting access to all of the previous Patreon exclusive episodes, of which there are like 30. I don't know. We should count at some point. But there are a lot.
Back, oh, yeah. It's like 60 or something.
It might be. Yeah. That's a lot. Anyway, so thank you to patrons. We're going to try to make sure we're always giving you guys something cool and new, and this season will not be an exception. And we're going to be talking about a lot of cool things starting today with our favorite films of the 1970s. So this is another top 10 episode. In this episode, Trisha, Brian, and Alex will be listing off their 10 favorite films of the 1970s. I will be listing off 10 films that I've seen from the 1970s. And there's an order that we like to do with these. So we're all going to go around and list our number 10 to number 4 in order. So just so like, you know, 10, 11, 9, 8. I'm doing the numbers wrong. You know what I'm saying?
Monday, Tuesday, Friday, Wednesday.
10, 11, 9, 8. Got it.
Yeah. 10, 11, 8. And so then we'll stop, and then everyone's going to go around and do their number 3s, and then number 2s, and then number 1s, and that is our finale. So
you listeners probably already know this. Michael is still struggling with the format.
Every time we do this, I have to, this is for me to remind myself who I'm calling on and what I'm calling on them for. And the order is going to be a little bit different this time. So we're going to start with Trisha, then it's going to go to me, then it's going to go to Brian, and then we're going to end with Alex.
No pressure, Alex.
You got this. Gotta be great picks. Okay, so before we get into going through our lists, we're going to talk about a little bit what was it like coming up with these lists, as we've liked to do in the past, like talking about sometimes it's hard to decide between best films or favorite films, and so everybody kind of develops a unique strategy. Trisha, what was your strategy as you chose your top 10 favorite films of the 1970s?
Listen, I get the appeal of doing this as like a thought exercise. And I guess if you're like the kind of person who's really into like personality tests or just lists in general, maybe that you would really enjoy doing this. I do not enjoy doing this because I feel a lot of pressure when I have to make my lists. And my initial list had 22 movies on it. And I did get it down to 10. I object to this whole thing. I'm angry that I'm here. And, I mean, the 1970s are just like some of the greatest movies of all time. And some of the movies that have like formed like what cinema is, especially in American cinema and what we think of it as. And so really hard for me to pare these down. And so also like, just want to say this really quick about these. If you ask me tomorrow, I would pick different movies. I would probably pick different movies. I picked different movies yesterday. I changed them today. Sometimes I make a game time decision as I'm saying my list out loud and say a different movie than I was planning to say. So this is not a personality test for me because it would be different in a matter of seconds. But here I am on this podcast where I have to say things into a microphone at a certain time.
Recorded and then sent
this
to the internet.
Yes. Right. The internet, which will haunt me until the day that I die. Indeed. Thanks.
Are you okay? Do we need a break? Like...
No, I mean, again, it's fun. It's a fun thought exercise. And then yet also it's a lot of pressure.
Yes. All right. Well, Brian, what about you? What's your strategy?
Well, I didn't need a strategy this time because this was the easiest list I had to make so far up until a point. So shortly after we did the 1980s episode, couldn't sleep one night. And I was just like, I want to start kind of writing down my 1970s movies. And I have a lot of time when I have insomnia. Yeah. It's when I look up what the First Wives Club is. Like,
it's an amazing movie.
I know. We talked about it. And I was like, oh, I have 10 movies on this list. Like I have lots of movies I love from this decade, but I was like, I have 10 where I would be really sad if any of these weren't on the list, and anything that's not on this list, I'm okay with. That's great. Job done. And then a week ago, I started putting together the list, like the final order and everything. And I went, oh, no, I have 11. And then I don't know which one was omitted initially. So then I had to do some agonizing and some soul searching over the past few days. And we can pour one out for Taxi Driver because it just missed. I always thought it was going to be on there, but it just missed. And the only other thing I think is going to be interesting is we're going to have, once we got into the 90s and 80s, we said a lot of it's just about what order we put them in. We're going to have a lot of crossover, right? And I think there's going to be a ton of crossover on this episode, except I don't know if my like top three, four maybe are going to be on anyone's list. And then most of the rest are going to be on everyone's list. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this goes.
Interesting. Okay.
Suspense.
Indeed. Alex, what about you?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because, you know, the 90s especially, but also the 80s, these are movies that were on the VHS tapes in my house growing up that I watched a million times. A lot of the classics from the 70s don't have that like extreme valence from childhood where, you know, there's the childhood thing where there's infinite time. So you can just rewatch a movie 1,000 times. Star Wars is an exception on this list, obviously. But for me, it was less... these are the movies I was obsessed with and more the movies I respect and love from this period, but kind of as an adult, with the exception of a couple that I think may not be on other people's lists as well, that are childhood movies. So that was where my list got really kind of weird. It started off as a very standard feeling list, just, this is AFI top 10 of the 70s, obvious stuff. And then I was like, but what's me? What are my favorite movies of the 70s? And there were a couple that have that childhood thing attached to them. And so they made it on the list. And that is, so mine's going to be, maybe start off a little funky and then get more traditional as it goes down.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Mm. Yeah. And yeah, just so what was hard for me is that there's a lot of movies that I've seen from the 70s, but haven't seen in a really long time. And I didn't have time to go back and rewatch. And so I'm like, I think I liked that movie, but I don't remember anything about it. Am I allowed to put that as a favorite movie of mine?
Right.
And so in general, I opted not to do that and went with movies that I can remember. But there, it's quite possible that in rewatching some of them, the order would move around. So we'll talk about it. We'll get into it. We'll see how this goes.
Nice.
Okay. So now, beginning with Trisha, we're going to go number 10 through number 4 on your list. Trisha, begin your list of your favorite films of the 1970s.
I shall. And I just want to tell you, Alex, that I had some of those childhood ones on my list also, and I cut them to try to make myself look cooler. Which for me, that was Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Fiddler on the Roof, which were two VHSs that we watched constantly. But those are not on my list because prestige. My number 10 is The Long Goodbye. My number 9 is The Conversation. My number 8 is Clute, which I've talked about on this show before. It was really hard to choose a Pacula movie because, like, LJ Pakula made so many amazing movies in this decade, but I tried to pick one from each director and like not more than one from each director. So I got my Coppola with The Conversation. I got my Pakula with Klute. I thought that was a little bit of a dark horse, but the one that I like the most. And then, of course, that's Chinatown. Six is Network. I gotta do it. Mm-hmm. Gotta do it. Five is Alien. And four is Star Wars.
Four. Nice. Okay. Interesting. Okay. So The Long Goodbye is one of those where I'm like, I think I liked it when I saw it, but I don't remember. So maybe if I saw it, that would be on my list. Conversation also is what I don't want to do too many spoilers, but there are things appearing on your list that's making me have those feelings. I'm like, see, maybe that is my favorite. I just don't remember.
Yeah, I just rewatched The Conversation like a few months ago, and it's really good. I haven't seen it in a long time. Yeah.
And as you might have been able to now ascertain, there are no Godfathers on my list because I've picked Conversation for my Coppola. So
bold.
Zero Godfathers. I know. I mean, listen, I do like them, but like these are favorites. Like, what do I want to put on and watch? And it's almost never The Godfather, to be honest, with respect, with the most deference ever to those films.
Unless you're trying to overthrow the Kens and then you want them to explain to talk over the whole movie.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess I am up now then. Okay. So number 10, Grease. Number 9, Love Annie it. Hall. Number 8, Jaws. 7, Rocky, which wouldn't have been on there had we not done our episode. Number 6, The Godfather Part 2. Number 5, The Godfather. Number 4, Chinatown.
Nice.
Just solid.
Grease. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have picked it for you. I'm very surprised.
So that was one where I was like, you know, I had The Conversation. I watched The French Connection last night because I was like, oh, I haven't seen that. Maybe that would get on here. Like, I don't know. Like, The Sting, I remember liking. So there was all these other movies that I was like, I probably should do those, but what movie did I watch a million times when I was a little kid? It was Grease, and I can't remember what happens in the plot of this movie, and I remember the words of every song for this other movie, Grease, so I think I should probably put Grease. So
I love it. Good. Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Hey, okay, good. Did good. All right, so Ryan, give us your list.
Okay, I promise this is not upside down, because my number 10 is Jaws, my number 9 is Alien. Going on from there, number 8 is Rocky, number 7 is The Godfather, number 6 is Annie Hall. I see you, Michael.
Yep.
Number 5 is Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, and number 4 is A Clockwork Orange.
Nice.
Okay.
Wow. Very solid list.
Also strong. Yeah.
Surprising order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting order.
I mean, we'll get into the top three, but it's what you were saying, Michael. It's just like, what are the movies that stuck with you the most? And I find that there were definitely movies that I grew up with. When I say grew up with, I mean saw when I was like 15 or something. And then like they really like, and Clockwork Orange is one of those that just really stuck with me for a while. And it's like, yeah, they're, you know, I like Jaws. I like, you know, but like those aren't the movies that I was watching like over and over again at that time. Right. Those formative years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Jaws, even for me, is like, had we not done the video about it a couple years ago, I don't think it would have been on my list. Cause like, I don't really like Jaws that much as a kid. But like, I appreciate it more now. So yeah, sort of, yeah. The relationship you have with movies that are this much older is interesting. Alex, what's your list?
Well, Michael, also number 10, Grease.
Hey!
Oh, that's so cute.
Grease buddies. Number 9.
Tell me more.
Number 9, Young Frankenstein.
Oh, nice.
Number 8, Rocky. Also, thanks to the podcast, because I had maybe seen parts of it, but never the whole thing, and never with the appreciation I have now from watching it recently.
Hey, guys, you're welcome. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you, Brian. Number 7, Network. Number 6, The Exorcist. Number 5, Alien. And number 4, also thanks to the podcast, Chinatown.
Nice. Very cool.
Got a number 4 overlap there. Okay.
Yeah, I could have told you none of us would have The Exorcist, probably. Well, I might be wrong. Maybe it is Brian. 3, 2, or 1.
Still time.
Who knows?
Ooh.
No, but Chinatown, like, really, it was almost top three, just because I loved it so much in this recent viewing, partly because of just how, I don't know, just how tight and intricate and wonderful it is as a screenplay, as a film, as a package. It just feels perfect in that classic movie way. So, yeah, Chinatown, man.
Good movie. Something that was happening for me also is, like, there were movies that in my head I was like, that's 70s, and then realized it was just after or just before.
Yeah.
And so there's 100%. A lot of, like, late 60s and early 80s movies that feel like 70s movies but aren't. It was also interesting. So, like I mentioned, I watched The French Connection last night for the first time. And it just, I feel like it's such a great example of, like, how filmmaking changed in the 70s. And so, you know, French Connection, there's a lot of handheld. They're on the streets of New York. It's, like, almost like cinema verite. Like, it feels real because you're there and you're on the streets and you had cameras and film in the 70s where you could hold it in your hand and walk around and, like, film stock that you could shoot, like, at night and all this stuff. And so it's just, it was interesting to remind myself of, like, the technology change that also happened going from the 50s and 60s to the 70s and 80s that allowed the sort of grittier aesthetic to even be possible to capture on film.
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned it a long time ago on the podcast, but I'm so fascinated by this decade in terms of the filmmaking. There were some movies that I saw when I was, like I said, you know, 15-ish, and it didn't really mean anything that they were from the 70s, especially a movie like Clockwork Orange, which feels like it's from no time. But then once I started, like, watching movies, capital M, you know, films, capital F, that I should watch, then I started just, there was, like, this 70s thing that I actually really didn't like. My friend and I were watching, we watched, like, Dog Day Afternoon and Straw Dogs, coming this, like, Sam Peckinpah kind of thing. I was just like, nothing is happening. This movie is so long and dry and whatever. And I'd have to rewatch some of those movies to see how I feel now. Maybe the conversation felt that way a little bit back then. But I've kind of fallen in love with that aesthetic now, where I just really love kind of sinking into these movies and just appreciating that they are just doing this pure vibes kind of thing, right? And like Taxi Driver is a good example. I just rewatched that a few days ago, and it's just like, oh yeah, I forgot how much of this movie is just like nothing happening for quite a while. I was just like, oh yeah, okay, we got to that part, so now we have to get to this part. It's like, no, there's 45 minutes before we get to, like, the last 10 minutes, which is, like, the whole rest of the movie. So yeah, I really, and especially as movies started to get more quick and edity and everything, then I started to be like, oh, wait a minute, what about the 70s? It was something I think some of the producers of The Social Network were saying, was that we're trying to make a movie that felt like it could have come out of the 70s, not aesthetic wise as much as just people in rooms talking, people kind of, you know, languidly walking across a campus while music plays, right? And you're just kind of living in that space and feeling that mood. So I really appreciate this decade, and I'm kind of, like, have been interested in revisiting some movies that didn't click with me back when I first watched them.
Yeah. Well, as a reminder, there was kind of, like, not the concept yet of, like, a big four quadrant, like, family movie. So a lot of the movies that have endured from this era before Star Wars. So Star Wars is 77, right? So, but the movies in the early and mid 70s that are enduring from this era are very adult films, right? They're, like, R-rated films. They're edgy. They're kind of difficult. They're not designed to be watched by, like, younger audiences. They're supposed to be kind of sophisticated and grim and grimy and all of these things that they are. And they're cool, right? Like, I actually looked it up just now. Midnight Cowboy was 1969, but it was an X-rated movie that won Best Picture at the Oscars, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, that was sort of what brought in this era of, like, very adult sort of, yeah, hard filmmaking in the 1970s. And part of the reason is because, you know, we talk about this new Hollywood school of filmmaking, and the director was essentially given a lot of leeway to make whatever he wanted to make. And so what you get is like things that these directors were interested in, you know, and they were adults and they wanted to make, you know, sort of complicated dramas most of the time, or you know, action movies like The French Connection, if you can think of it that way, like, and heist movies and things like this. And not that some of these movies aren't still really fun. Like Jaws is 1975. It's almost a family movie, except when it's completely horrifying. But like, you know, a lot of these films are the ones that we remember because they were being helmed by these directors with these visions, and they were not at all worried about having an audience. They were just like aimed squarely at adults. They didn't care really about like appealing to a wide variety of people if it was sort of like this. Yeah. I mean, this is a great era for thrillers, right? Like I talked about Pacula and some of these, but it's like these were movies for grownups. And grown-ups went to the movies in the 70s, and the movies we still watch today are mostly those films. And animation was kind of having a, you know, the 30s and 50s were sort of the golden era of Disney and animation, and that was kind of not happening, you know, in the 1970s as much, or like those films aren't the ones that we remember until the Disney Renaissance in the 80s and 90s. So this was kind of that, like, adults making adult movies for adults at the cinema. Kind of a thing.
Kramer versus Kramer, that kind of.
Right, Kramer versus like, Kramer, yeah. Was on my list of 22 nice. Movies. But yes, I mean, it's exactly that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like some like formal experimentation also, like yeah, the conversations on your list, it's just like listening to people, the movie, and like the French Connection is just like following people, the movie, like,
yep.
But just like really doubling down on like this thing. How do we portray it cinematically? It's happening in a lot of these movies too. Mm.
That yeah, the conversation just like that's a vibes movie like crazy. And I think I don't know that I would have appreciated it the first time I watched it, but watching it this time, I was just like, oh, like it almost feels like Taxi Driver in that way, where I just kind of want to soak up this weird sort of lonely dreamscape kind of place that it's inhabiting. It's really interesting.
Gene Hackman is an interesting actor. And like, anyway, yeah, at some point we'll talk about like one of those movies, I'm sure. Okay. Now it's time to go to our number threes. So, Trisha, what is your number three favorite film of the 1970s?
I'm so excited to tell you guys all of this. My number three is Breaking Away, which I don't think any of you have seen. You have? Oh, great. Awesome. I can't wait to tell you about it. For those of you that have no idea what it is, this is a sports movie. It's so good. It was nominated for 5 Oscars. It won an Oscar for Best Screenplay. It is from 79. So this was a little bit later. Yeah, in the 70s. And I really have to give my father credit for this one because actually really my dad credit for all of these because these are like all some of his favorite movies. But it's a movie about like a teenage kid in a rural town who like takes up cycling, and he like it's just this coming of age movie. It's really lovely. It's really funny. I just adore it. I've seen it a bunch of times. It's an incredible screenplay. It's one of those that like I could analyze endlessly about why the script is so good. But it's, you know, kind of a small, quiet movie. It stars Daniel Stern and Jackie Earle Haley and Dennis Christopher and Dennis Quaid, a very young Dennis Quaid in a very small pair of jean shorts. And it's just like everything about this movie is just incredible. It's what I want. It's like this inspirational story. And it's a feel good movie from the 70s. They made a couple. They squeaked him in 1979, I guess. And right. Yeah, it rules. So, yeah, Breaking Away is my number three.
Nice. Okay.
That's definitely a dad movie. My dad is also the reason I know that movie and have seen it. Yeah.
All of mine are really, truly dad movies. Like, I mean, dads really had their heyday in the 70s.
Nice. Okay. All right. So my turn. So my number three favorite film of the 70s is Apocalypse Now. I don't know. I feel like it's one of those formal like experience movies where I remember watching it for the first time and just having my mind blown of like, what is this? Where am I? Like, I'm just absorbed into this movie. We talked about it a lot in our episode, which is one of my favorite episodes in conversation, just because this movie is so interesting and kind of unlike anything else. And so it was cool when I first saw it. It was cool the last time I saw it. I feel like there's just always going to be something in there that I really like. Sometimes even I quote lines from that movie to myself. You know, there's the because I'm going crazy.
Which
apparently.
Yeah, that's,
but you know, the I love the smell of napalm in the morning, obviously, is the famous line. But the line right after that, where he's just like, you know, one of these days this war is going to end. And like the way he says it, there's just mm-hmm. something in it of like, he's like sad, but like there's just so much in that. And it's just like nothing else captures whatever that feeling is. Like,
when do you say that?
I'm not going to talk about that right now.
What is but, the
when
context?
But when I need to say it, it comes in. It's very handy. It captures yep. it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just Coppola. I mean, we're not going to be the first person to mention this, but like 72, The Godfather. 74, The Conversation and The Godfather Part 2. 79, Apocalypse Now. Like, what a run.
What a run.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
And then One from the Heart.
Okay. Brian, what is your number three?
My number three is The Exorcist.
Nice. The minute I said it, I was like, nope. I'm very wrong about that.
Yeah, I was like, what are you talking about, Trisha?
Exorcist, gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, I really do love this movie. I think there are movies that I, you know, was excited by when I was younger. And then as I've gotten older, I'm like, it kind of wore off. But every time I watch this movie, I'm just like, I really love the directing and the mood and that it sets. And then it's doing really interesting thematic stuff. And I like being scared by horror movies. I like being put in that place. It's like if I watch a rom-com, it's to feel those emotions. If I watch a horror movie, it's to feel those emotions. And I feel like I'm consistently disappointed by horror movies when they cease to give me anything. It doesn't even have to be like scared as much as just like unease or chill or whatever. And this is one of the few movies that I can like just think of certain parts of it and it gives me chills. And when I watch it, it just puts me in this like very, very uneasy state that I enjoy being in because I know I can can leave at the end.
Yeah, man. Ari Aster in an interview at some point talked about, I think, movies that inspired him. And I don't know if he mentioned The Exorcist, but he said movies that seem like they are evil, like yeah. there's something evil about them in their DNA. Like it's like it's an artifact that is like evil at its core. And I think The Exorcist feels like one of those movies. I think Ari Aster's movies also feel that way.
Yeah.
He has successfully replicated the feeling of evil at the core of his films. But yeah, I remember watching The Exorcist for the first time. Well, the first time I watched it, I walked out of the theater because I was in seventh grade with my dad and it was a re-release.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I can't handle this. And we left. But when I actually got through the whole movie, there was that feeling of, yeah, this is evoking emotions in me unlike anything else. Like I am so deeply unnerved and disturbed and chilled, like you were saying, Brian. And that's just always really impressive when a film can like give you the full body experience of really deep, weird emotions.
It's interesting because that's like why I avoided that movie for the majority of my life was like, you know, my mom basically saying that of like, that movie is like, there's evil inside of it, like stay away. And it was like, freaked me out enough that I'm like, oh yeah, that's fine. If something's evil, I will avoid it, obviously. yeah.
But then you watched it.
But then I watched it. Yeah. Probably too late.
Was it evil?
I kind of giggled the whole time. I feel like I had built it up so much in my head and I watched it like so late in life that it would have been impossible to like actually like meet or surpass my expectations.
You need to be an innocent 12-year-old in theater.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. I've had it on my never watch list for quite a while. So I don't plan on moving it, but that's where it sits. And maybe, you know, I would think it's funny actually. I don't think so. I think it's going to stay on my never watch list.
Probably not. Yeah, I think that's probably a good call.
I agree.
Yeah. Alex, what's your number three?
My number three is Star Wars, A New Hope. Nice. And yeah, what is there to say about this movie? I just, you know, it probably changed my life and everybody else's lives. It changed cinema. I mean, it's hard because I do feel like for me, Star Wars has become tainted. It's that thing where too much of a good thing becomes a bad thing. And it's like the Star Wars brand is so many things now and not what it once was. So in some ways it maybe has fallen on the list because of just the time and what has passed, you know, in the last couple of decades around Star Wars. But you know, just thinking about the influence it has had on everything and on myself and the kinds of genres I'm interested in, the kinds of movies or games or anything that I want to be a part of, it's Star Wars is at least 50% of that equation. Star Trek, maybe another good chunk of it. Alien movies as well. But Star Wars is the majority, probably.
Yeah, I had to come to terms with the fact that I don't love the first movie as much as I do the other two. And there was definitely, because I think it's like a really solid, you know, and I'm sure someone here might, you know, tell us why it's great soon. But no, I think it's a really solid, like, I mean, really, it's an incredible start to this franchise, right? And I absolutely appreciate it for that. But in terms of my own, what I want for a movie, it's just like, there's like a simplicity to it, which I think works really well for it, but it's just not my thing that I want, which is like the weirdness of the other two movies. So there was a quick moment where I was like, is it even on my top 10? And then I was like, no, of course it is. And it's like reasonably high. It's just not like top three level for me. So that was an interesting conversation to have with myself.
Right. And that's kind of the weird place I'm in too, where do I want to go watch Star Wars A New Hope at all anymore? I don't think I need to or do, but just the impact on my life, you know, counterbalances that and makes it, you know, the number three spot.
Right.
We'll have a screening party. We'll get two TVs. On one TV, you guys can watch The Exorcist, and Trish and I will watch Star Wars on the other TV.
Perfect.
This is like a great party. Yeah.
Very strange party.
Yeah, I feel like it'll be a lot of fun. Okay. All right. Well, we have our number threes in. Are we ready to move to number two? Let's, Trisha.
I think we can.
What is your number two favorite film of the 1970s?
This one goes directly out to my father. It is The Sting from 1974. Nice. In fact, 1974's Best Picture, and was nominated for 10 Oscars. It won 7, including Best Picture that year. In my father's hometown, when he was a younger person and going to see that movie, it ran in his hometown theater for one whole year. It was just consistently selling to crowds. It is an amazing movie. My love of heist movies is directly born out of The Sting, and I just really love it. It's just so fun. It's so entertaining. It's so watchable. Like, Robert Redford and Paul Newman are gorgeous and amazing, and like, I just, it's so good. I don't know, everything about it, the twists and turns, it's so twisty, like, and you're just with the characters the whole time. I would love to do a podcast about it one day. I've seen it a number of times, and every time I watch it, the ragtime soundtrack becomes very tiring at a certain point. But other than that, I have zero complaints about The Sting. It rules.
There are definitely some films from the 70s or 80s around this era where it's just like, this movie's amazing, but yeah, this music choice, very much of this moment or this weird taste of the time, is not aging well.
I think it can be polarizing too. Like, my friend hates the Blade Runner score, and I think it's like the best thing ever, you know? And it's like, right. But yeah, that, like, but the Terminator, the original Terminator, I think the score really takes my attention away from the movie when I watch it now, and other people are like, you're crazy, it's amazing. So it's just, it really depends on, it's like a very much litmus test, I think, for certain people.
Yeah.
I think the way score was used in 70s movies is different than in modern day. And so, yeah, it creates that kind of thing.
It's funny you mentioned Blade Runner, Brian, because that, Michael said, you know, some of these movies feel like they should be from the 70s, and Blade Runner is one of them, I think, because of the score. Yeah, yeah. Also the vibes and just the wanderiness of it, but the score feels very 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Sting, was on my list of, I think this is actually probably one of my favorite movies, but I couldn't tell you what happens in it, so I probably shouldn't put it on the list.
But you should rewatch it.
I would love to, because I remember really liking it. So I do want to watch it again. We should do an episode about that.
Yeah.
I'm on board.
I'm into it.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Okay, so my number two favorite movie of the 70s is Alien. Probably surprising no one.
It's surprising no one.
Yeah.
Is that a bingo? is that our first bingo?
Should be, yeah.
Is it?
We've all said Alien, yeah.
Did we? Okay.
Yeah.
Nice, all right. Good. Really, that's our first.
That's our first surprising. Bingo?
I think so.
Wow.
Interesting, okay. Yeah, again, we've talked about Alien a lot. It's a masterpiece. I love it. It's like exactly the right blend of like filminess and like horror freakiness. It like scared the hell out of me as a kid, but also like made me want to make movies and how did you do this? This is amazing. And like sci-fi and all these things. So yeah, in my brain, it's like essentially a perfect movie and I love it. And I would probably watch it anytime. So Alien.
We'll put that on our third TV at our party.
There we go.
And then all four of us can just sort of...
Universal donor. Also.
Yeah. I feel like Alien is kind of the midsection between Star Wars and The Exorcist.
Yeah, there you go. Totally. Yeah. Hey. Spectrum.
The middle TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. All right, Brian, what's your number two?
My number two is Being There.
I knew
the
it.
Al Ashby movie, yeah, from 1979. It was my number one for a while, and also one that I saw later. So it sort of had more work to do. It had more had to do more work to get to the top over movies that I watched a bunch when I was 16 or 17. Our buddy Sean Eastridge over in the Missing Frames podcast. You can hear me show him that movie for the first time over there and hear my extended thoughts. But it's really well made. It's the themes, just like really, really strong themes that never fail to just strike me and make me kind of think about what the movie is doing. Peter Sellers and Shirley MacLaine are just outstanding. Mm-hmm. And they're just so good. There's a plot contrivance that is at the center of this movie that I think is actually really cleverly done. And it's interesting to see how they sort of make you buy that all these things that the movie is sort of selling are actually happening. And there's just something about Hal Ashby's direction. I realized this and Harold Maud of just like, he does this so, so beautiful, kind of gritty, kind of sweet, like 60s song playing, folk song kind of playing thing that just really strikes me. And I realized that John Cameron Mitchell said that that's what he was doing when he did Hedwig, when he directed Hedwig. He said, I want to direct it like a Hal Ashby movie. And I feel like that actually comes through so hard. And I actually really love the holdovers from this year, which feels like so directly Alexander Payne trying to do the exact same thing. And it's like, even when someone is trying to do it, it still really works for me. So yeah, Being There, number two.
Very nice. I had Harold and Maude on my list of 22 and I was thinking about it. And then I was like, Hal Ashby will get some love. He will get some love. Yep. I'm not worried about it. Brian's here. We're going to have Being There. It's going to be okay. I do really love Harold and Maude though.
Yep. Like,
yeah. So good.
Yeah. Glad you shouted out Missing Frames also, because that's what made me watch The Exorcist for the first time. So if you want to hear my live reaction to like or hot take reaction to The Exorcist, you can check out that episode of Missing Frames.
Giggling, apparently.
A little bit of giggling. I watched it with our friend Wyatt also. I feel like that was maybe added to the giggling.
That's guaranteed that giggles.
We gave it a fair shot. We were both. Anyway. Okay, Alex, bring us at number two. What's your favorite number two?
My number two is Apocalypse Now.
Hey.
For a lot of the same reasons you mentioned, Michael, just it's and kind of like what I was saying about The Exorcist as well, it's just one of those full body experience movies where I walk out of watching that movie and I feel like I'm on drugs and I'm kind of tripping and reality seems different for a little bit. And I'm always really impressed when I can walk out of just like viewing and hearing something and literally my state of consciousness is temporarily altered and kind of like screwed up for a bit. And Apocalypse Now does that. And it's just such an amazing, strange like all consuming journey to go on that ride in that movie. And yeah, it just, it's one of a kind and so special. And I am always down to watch it. Basically, it's a movie that's both difficult, but also kind of not difficult, because there's something pleasurable about the filmmaking and how weird and crazy it is. And the audiovisual experience is, it's not doing the minimalist gritty thing. You know, there's like war movies or Academy movies that are, look how serious we are, we're going to be very spare and minimal, and like you will suffer with the characters in this minimal, like bare bones way. Apocalypse Now is like horrific suffering and horrific, like strange things happening, but in this like lush, gorgeous way. and I appreciate that. And it makes it rewatchable for me and always an experience worth going on.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, essentially exactly what you said is what's like, cinema is insane, basically. You can go in and we're going to flash right. images at you 24 times a second for like 2 hours, and we're going to play some sound at you, and you will like glean meaning from that. Like, that is pretty cool. And I feel like that movie is like such a distillment of that process in a way that like makes the kind of magic of that more accessible, and just because it is so weird and such a trip.
And as we talked about in the podcast, like, it holds up so hard. Like, it's just, it still looks incredible to the point where you're just like, you know, and I think it's that practical versus CG thing, right? It's like, we've seen things 6,000 times bigger than that movie in theaters, but we haven't seen anything that feels as big as that movie, or we haven't seen much that feels as big as that movie, I think, for me.
It's like, how did they do this? This seems impossible.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it is now time for our number ones. Are we ready for this? Does everybody have their seatbelts on? Do they have seatbelts?
I don't know what Alex is. What?
Brian knows what mine and Michael's are. Yeah. He doesn't know Alex's.
Everyone does. But yeah.
Yeah.
Do you guys know what mine is?
No.
I don't think so.
No.
Okay. All right.
We don't have the brain. We don't have the like fact thing in my, at least I don't have the like fact tracking in my brain that you do, Brian. So
oh yeah, my brain is just steel trap for the most useless information, and I could not tell
Brian's
you how
brain is a spreadsheet of trivia.
But like taxes, how cars work, I don't know.
Yep,
that's not that important in the grand scheme of things. This is
so what's my number one, Brian?
Guess I'm gonna go on a limb and say it's Jaws.
It's definitely Jaws. Hey. Yeah, it's Jaws. Of course it is. Yeah, this movie, super influential on me. I love every frame of it. It's amazing. I'm the one who insisted we do a video on it on the channel. I think it's endlessly studyable, and also just, I don't know, everything about it, like, it's scary but thrilling but heroic and adventurous. It becomes like this seafaring adventure in the middle. The character, a triangle of the three men on the boat who are hunting the shark, amazing. It's amazing. It's just an amazing movie, and I could watch it at any point. And like, I remember where I was when I watched that shark explode for the first time. Just like, oh yes,
shark chunks.
I'm so happy. Yeah. Well, I also remember where I was when I saw the Death Star explode for the first time, and just the emotional release of like seeing the big bad thing blow the hell up is just so intense, like cinema.
Spielberg and Lucas, they really cracked that code in the 70s.
Just blow it up at the end. It's amazing.
When Luke closes his eyes and says, "Smile, you son of a bitch," and the dust arose.
Exactly what I'm saying. Yes. Anyway, it's amazing. I love this movie. Yep. But it wasn't even close. My top three were not even like hard to pick. So
yeah.
I realize we have this, you and I have this inverse Spielberg thing where I realize that Jurassic Park just missed my top 10 of the 90s. Last Crusade.
Unbelievable.
I know. Last Crusade just snuck in on my 80s, and Jaws just snuck in my 70s. And for you, these are like your literally
the number one. Yeah. The number one. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. They don't like the blowing up thing. We really don't blow things up the way they used
really
to.
We really don't.
Well, they're blowing up the whole time, and the blowing up becomes meaningless. It's just blow up every scene. Yeah.
And, well, I'll talk about this in a second. Brian, what's my number one?
It is the laser sword movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the War of the Stars. So yeah, so obviously Star Wars is my favorite film of the 70s, probably still my favorite film of all time. Lots of things to talk about, but I want to continue about on this blowing up track because, so the Death Star, like we're saying, is this amazing catharsis of just like, and then boom, it's like gone. And I feel like one of my problems with the prequels and then kind of every movie since is I feel like Lucas even like wanted the explosions to feel more realistic. So like when the pod racers like crash, you know, the engine falls and then it tumbles on the ground and then pieces come off and it's like, oh yeah, I guess that's how things like actually happen. But in Star Wars, you couldn't do that. You filmed a fireball and you put it over the model going boom and it was great.
Yep.
Bring back simple fireball explosions. Simple
yes. Explosions. Yeah. Like this, but like even Rogue One did so many throwbacks to like the original Star Wars, but the booms still weren't. Like there's too much debris.
It's too real.
Clean.
It's too much realism in the booms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and with Jaws and with Star Wars, it's like there's the one last shot, right? And it's like, you have to get the one last shot or it's like absolutely, it's all or nothing on the last shot that you have. And then when you get the all, right, like the tension is high. It has funneled all of the tension down to this like point the size of a womp rat or in, you know, the size of like an air tank or whatever. And it's just like, it has funneled everything down to this and it's like this or nothing and complete failure. And so the explosion should be like this huge emotional release and shouldn't challenge your brain, right? It just should be this like, and then it was over, right? And like this hail of shark blood and parts just rained on the sea later. And then it's just like, it should be that. And then you can just move on. And then both of those movies, there's a little bit more in Star Wars with like the ceremony and everything, but they just like get out quick after that. Like, this is it. The movie is over. We've moved on. Like, we're going to paddle back to shore. We're going to hand out some medals and that's going to be the end. And I love it. I love it. It's just so archetypal, simple, like storytelling.
It'd be really interesting to overlay like that, the last sequences of Jaws and Star Wars to see just like the ebb and flow, how like in sync they are. I'd be really curious, to see how that lines up.
When I thinking to Star Wars, you know, I was mentioning a moment ago, like, oh yeah, I don't gotta watch it again. But honestly, every time I watch that finale, it does get me because like all the layers are working in that moment. You've got the use the force, Luke. You've got the swell of the, you know, force theme and Luke's theme. It just, there's so much magic happening in that. Like tightening. And then the release, as you said, Trisha, it's just masterful. The amount of emotional layers, tension layers, and then all at once catharsis is just so good.
John Williams is there playing the hell out of whatever he's playing. Yeah. We love it.
So good. That's the thing. When I think about Star Wars, I'm kind of like, I don't know if I'm like excited to see like that scene or that scene, but it's just like Luke standing, looking at the two sunsets with John Williams score. I'm just like, yes, I want to watch that scene for sure.
It's pure cinema.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just had a thought. Alex, what is your favorite film of all time?
Of all time?
Yeah. Is it Jurassic Park? Is it Children of Men?
I think Children of Men is still the one of just like the movie that I can't find any flaw with whatsoever.
Which means we all have favorite movies from different decades.
Of all timers, you mean?
Yes. I think Star Wars.
If you had picked Jurassic Park, it would be the same as mine. So.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So Labyrinth from the 80s for me, Star Wars from the 70s, and Jurassic Park for Trisha, and Children of Men for the odds. I don't know what that means, but it's interesting. It's
good spread.
Or is it? Tell us.
Trivia.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't done our what's our favorite films of all time list. I guess there's still time.
Oh, no. No.
You're going to make me cry.
That's impossible. I mean, it's possible, but.
That's impossible.
I mean, is that what's next for the top 10?
I feel like we need to at least do a pre 1970s episode.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, like we could do everything pre 1970s. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. But, guys, we're not starting yet.
We're still recording.
Okay. So Star Wars for Michael. Brian, what is your favorite film of the 1970s?
So anytime you hear me talking about the movies that I watched all throughout my teen years and everything, all of them except for one will have been talked about on these episodes. So Seven, Labyrinth, Natural Born Killers, Clockwork Orange, Exorcist, and the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yep.
Is my number one. Yeah. I just watched it over and over again. I mean, it was one of those movies I would sometimes just like rewind the tape and just start it again. Like, it's just like, I'm going to put it on again. And it's so entertaining. Tim Curry is amazing. The music is awesome. Everyone in it is just, it's so fun. And surprisingly, a movie with a bit of thematic conversation going on. It's not super complex, but it's there. And, you know, I mentioned this in the Seven podcast, but I really am appreciating that all those movies I just listed, they were sort of training me to spot theme in movies, I think. Like, I didn't call it theme at the time. It was more just like, what is this movie trying to say? You know, we grew up reading the Aesop's Fables, where then at the bottom, it would just be like moral. And then it would say like a one sentence thing. And I think that like, that's what I was looking for in movies. And all of these movies, so different movies from different decades, different genres, they all had something that stuck with me and made me think like what the movie was trying to say. So there was just something, and some of them were screaming it loudly. Some of them were complex, where there was kind of like, what does this movie mean? I don't know. I want to think about it for a while. Right. But they all kind of just like challenged me to dig a little deeper and think about that. And also just love them as a piece of entertainment that I could watch over and over again. The strange person that I am is thanks to all of these movies that I watched a bunch around this age, and Rocky Horror was maybe the one up there with Labyrinth, the one I watched the most.
Did you go to like Rocky Horror?
I've never gone to a screening. I'm a virgin. Yep.
After all that?
Yep.
That's so weird. Whoa, that's the weirdest thing I've ever heard.
That's impossible.
I did dress up as Frankenfurter for Halloween twice, and surprisingly enough, there are zero pictures of this as evidence.
So you have a costume, and you've never been to a screening.
I don't have it anymore. This was a long, long time ago. But no, I have not. I have not been to a screening.
Well, I want this for you.
Somebody
now.
Somebody invite Brian to a
podcast field trip.
Good grief.
Yeah, so I don't think I've ever seen the movie like start to finish. It's one of those things though that just like is everywhere. And I remember as a kid, teenager, like going through the world, you just see references to it and other things, or you hear people talking about like, you know, these shows, or like your classmates in the drama room walk by and they're dressed all weird and you're like, where are they going? They're like Rocky Horror Picture. Like what? Like what? And so it's been really interesting kind of like through osmosis absorbing the movie and the story and all of it. And like part of me has avoided watching the actual thing just because it's really fun only knowing about it like through other people and through culture. So I don't know if I'm going to watch it or not, but it's interesting.
Field trip.
Maybe field trip. Yeah. I feel like maybe I've seen it. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Okay.
All right.
Alex, we're all shivering with anticipation.
Nope. Brian.
my number one is The Godfather.
Oh, yeah.
So ending on a traditional note here. And I think, you know, there's head and heart choices on this list. And this one's a bit more head. But I when I just think back on films, when I saw them in the proper setting, and for me, it was seeing The Godfather at the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood. They did a 4K restoration re-release thing. And I just was like, oh, I get it. This movie is immaculate in its, you know, just every aspect of the filmmaking here is elegant and like pure and just really, there's something just like the texture of the film, everything about it just feels like, I don't know, just good. And so I think when I decide about what movie just like holistically is just very good from this era and like kind of unimpeachably good, The Godfather, I can't deny it. And I do, I do love watching it in the right context, you know, because I think right so often now we're living these like distracted lives with our phones like half out as we're watching TV, yada yada. This is not the kind of movie you want to watch in that headspace. But it's the kind of movie that when I'm in a dark, you know, can't do anything else theatrical space, it is a really enjoyable experience. So yeah, The Godfather made it to my number one, even though it's not a movie that I watch over and over again or I'm obsessed with. It's just that good. It deserves to be there.
Yeah, I like the head and the heart thing. I was thinking about sort of like what's my, if there's like a scale where, you know, how much you appreciate a movie is up here, but then down here is how much you actually like watching it. And then some movies are the other way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Chinatown, for instance, we talked about, it's a movie that like I like it, but I appreciate it more. And then, you know, Rocky Horror Picture Show is a movie that I like more than I appreciate as a film, right? I'm just like, no, I just like it. It's just fun. And I feel like Godfather, and I, honestly, Godfather Part Two, I feel a little that way where I'm just sort of like, I appreciate it more than I actually enjoy the process of watching it, even though I do really like it. But yeah, Godfather feels like one of those movies that I should be like, I appreciate it, but I don't really love watching it, but I just really love watching it. Like it kind of works both ways, which is really impressive.
Yeah. Part two for sure doesn't really work for me in a lot of ways, which I feel guilty about because it's often held up as like the better one even. I honestly never really enjoy watching it start to finish. I don't know what it is, but the first one, not the case. The first one, I am like you, Brian, I'm both appreciating it and I'm not shifting in my seat, kind of wondering what the hell I'm doing here. I am like enjoying it scene by scene, moment to moment.
One thing I would like to hear from listeners potentially on social media or on the Discord is for those that are younger, like, and maybe didn't get introduced to some of these movies when they were young, which in fairness, you know, we came to a lot of these movies as adults also, but I do wonder how like a younger, like a Gen Z would have the, I don't know, what they would think of some of the pacing and like style of 70s movies. Because as I mentioned, sometimes they are kind of difficult, right? Like there is a complexity to them and the way that they look and the way that they're paced. And we talked about the score and all these things. They're so different from like modern filmmaking that I do wonder how like young viewers think of them. Like, are they just the way that we think of movies from the, I don't know, 40s and 50s or something? Like, I don't know. I'm very curious to hear from people about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and again, like I said, watching like French Connection, like the language of cinema was different. Like we speak a different like dialect of like filmmaking now. And I watched that, you know, as that famous car chase. And then I watched the Batman car chase because I listened to
interesting.
So I listened to an interview with the cinematographer and they talked about the French Connection being a big like inspiration for them. And so watching those two things back was interesting. And it was, yeah, intriguing to see how those influences had been adapted, but it still just felt different. Like there's something about the way movies, we expect them to be paced and the music and like all these things that it's just like different. And I don't know that we can ever like capture like that moment in time and that all of those things ever again. And I feel like the 70s in particular is like distinct in that way, which is, yeah, just interesting and special.
Yeah, I wonder if there was just like you know how film developing kind of moves in like trends and certain other kinds of like color grading moves in trends and like aspect ratio, like all these kind of things become like trendy. And so everyone wants their movie to kind of look like this one movie. And then they kind of all grade it all that way. Or like, were all these guys shooting on the same film stock? Like, or they had, you know, they all went to the same schools because they literally did. Or like, you know, I wonder what it was about why they all kind of have the same vibe. And I don't know if you shot on film today, like if you got the film stock and somebody experienced in developing it the same way and, you know, you shot natural light or like in studios with the kind of like lighting that they did and these kinds of things, could you make a movie that was like indistinguishable from a 70s movie, or would it inevitably look modern? Is there something in the mm-hmm. water, air, DNA mm-hmm. Now that would change it irreparably? I wonder.
I mean, because there's just so many things that, like, the confluence of technology, like, again, watching 70s movies, remembering, oh, cutting literally meant cutting. Like, hey, there have the every time you're cutting, someone had to physically cut the film and, like, tape it together. Like, it wasn't easy to make a movie back then. And so I feel like there is just this so many, like, ineffable things, technology and else, and just the cultural moment that, like, all... Yeah, I don't think you can make a 70s movie outside of the 70s, but...
The challenge is issued. You heard it here.
I mean, I will say the holdovers, like, really surprised me in what it did in that regard.
The trailer was broadcasting that hard.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But I mean, it does the, like, they're walking through the snow and then it's doing that sort of slow zoom kind of thing that they were doing. And, like, again, the Hal Ashby thing. And then they're playing some folk song over it. And I was like, wow, I was really impressed by how well you're nailing this. And, you know, Spielberg's West Side Story, I think there was a similar thing, not 70s, sure. but 60s, where it was just like the color grading. There's something about it that just made me go, if you put a frame of this movie or, you know, 30 seconds of this movie in front of me and said, what decade is this from? I don't know if I would think it was like a highly remastered thing from the 60s, Mike, but I don't know that I could tell you that it was definitely not.
Yeah, fascinating.
The color grading of this era is going to be like very low contrast, very gray, washed out, beautifully crisp images.
Well, oh yeah. So it's just now 2024. I'm really hoping that we get away from like the teens look and that the 20s become something different.
Right.
Because I'm tired. Yeah. I'm tired of the teens and how it looked.
Yeah. It's the era where our screens can display the most contrast ever and our movies have the least contrast ever, and it's just so
maybe
puzzling.
Partially because we have dynamic range, we want to get into the like minutia of dynamic range instead of just like the ends, you know.
I don't know. I mean, the two biggest movies of the year were Barbie and Oppenheimer, so we can have a that's contrast true. Conversation
sure, something's changing it. Maybe yeah, things
yeah. Are changing. We're gonna
yeah. Yes, we are. So again, to run through all of the movies that we're going to be talking about this season, our Best Picture winter season, Chinatown, available right now over on the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon. We've just talked about our favorite films of the 1970s. Poor Things is next week, which I'm so excited to talk about. Anatomy of a Fall, Patreon exclusive, a conversation about acting. Past Lives, Dune Part 2, Fargo, and Oppenheimer are all coming down the pipe. Going to be a really interesting season. I'm
hell yeah.
Very much looking forward to it. So we want to say a big thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. If you want to support the podcast and get access to some of these patron exclusives, head over to the Beyond Screenplay Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major. Thank you to our editors, Donovan Bullen, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we will see you in the next episode for our discussion of Poor Things.
Bye, everybody.
Patient.
Bye.